Comrade Lenin said that capitalism is horror without end. And if one looks at the ghastly spectacle of the brutal and blood-soaked events that are taking place in Gaza at the present time, the truth of this statement, I think, is clear. I'll begin with a quote from a Palestinian in Gaza. Speaking over a mobile phone, he says the following. 3 children in my neighborhood were killed last night. The walls in my house are shaking. This is an ordinary civilian, an ordinary person. The walls in my house are shaking. Every minute there are explosions. Every minute there are martyrs. We can't sleep. We can't move. We have almost no food, no electricity, and it's very cold. Now, the images of the suffering, of the martyrdom of the people of Gaza, have gone on the television screens of the whole world and have caused a colossal impact in the consciousness of people all over the world, beginning in the Middle East. And this undoubtedly will have a most profound effect on many levels in the period that now opens up. However, despite this natural feeling of revulsion to the horrors of war, a Marxist tendency must not allow its opinions to be shaped just by emotions on any question, least of all on war. Least of all on war. In particular, we must not pay any attention to the deafening chorus of the petty bourgeois pacifists, and above all, the disgusting cynicism of all the bourgeois politicians, so-called democratic politicians in Washington, and particularly in Europe, who are weeping every day, they're weeping crocodile tears about the horrors, the violence. Oh, this violence must stop. Look at all these people being killed. They all sing the same song. They conveniently forget the fact that America, Britain, and the other so-called coalition powers have killed and slaughtered many more innocent men, women, and children, and are still doing so in Iraq and above all in Afghanistan than what the Israeli army is now doing. Many more. But that's okay. That's okay for these great Democrats. In other words, all this diplomatic farce and circus of calling for peace and ceasefire and an end for the violence and all these tears is just so much stinking hypocrisy. That's at that level. As far as the petty bourgeois pacifists are concerned, well, they're against all war and all violence. All violence is bad and it's wrong to kill people and so on. They even talk about humanitarian purposes during a war. Now, this is a little bit silly. It's a little bit silly. Let us be clear. Wars are about killing people. The whole purpose of a war is to kill people. You cannot have a humanitarian war. That's a contradiction in terms. The purpose of a war is what? It is to force, for one side, to force another side to submit to its will. And preferably to disarm the other side such that it cannot fight. And that's the purpose of this war. That's all the Israelis are doing. They want to force the Palestinians, the Gazans, the Hamas, force them to their knees. Now, our attitude to war, the Marxist attitude to war, is not shaped by humanitarian and pacifist and nice moral principles. That's not how our attitude is shaped at all. Nor is it shaped by the usual diplomatic nonsense about who is the aggressor. The Israelis stand up and say, "No, it's just a war of defense, you understand. This is a defensive war because, look, Hamas is firing rockets against our people. It's killing our people. We must protect ourselves. Therefore, this is a defensive war on the standpoint of Israel." And by the way, that's an important argument because many Israeli Jews have accepted this. That's why, for the time being, at least for the time being, that can change. But initially, at least, there's been no big protests inside Israel of the Jewish Israelis. There have been some protests of some thousands of people in the north and other areas, but I think you'll find they're mainly Arab Israelis at this stage. I think that will change, but at this stage it's the case. Because of the stupidity of Hamas in this nonsense of firing rockets against Israeli, which are they're primitive rockets, they can't even aim these rockets. And therefore they are indiscriminate, they land anywhere, they can land on a school, they can land on a village, that's perfectly true. And this madness, this stupidity of Hamas, serves to show the complete stupidity of all individual terrorism as a method. Our objection to firing rockets and suicide bombings and so on, our objection has nothing in common with the hypocrisy of Bush or Brown. George Bush is the biggest terrorist in the world. I repeat, they've killed many more, and they are killing many more civilians than the Israelis. That's not so. So they have no right to complain about these methods. Terrorism, if you like, is a method of the weak against the strong. We have to understand that. So when Hamas says, look, we are the weak party, we're fighting against a powerful state, we have no alternative but to use these primitive methods and so on, well, we understand what they're saying. We don't condemn them out of hand. If they say, we have the right to defend ourselves, we say, yes, you have the right to defend yourself. That's correct. However, if you are conducting a serious struggle against Israeli imperialism, which after all is a very powerful state and a very powerful army, you should use methods which are adequate to your struggle. You should use methods that serve the purpose of national liberation and not counterproductive methods. And these methods are clearly counterproductive. Because they talk about armed struggle against Zionism. Where's the armed struggle against Zionism? Where's the armed struggle against Zionism? Firing these silly rockets against them? That's not an armed struggle. From a military point of view, these rockets do not cause a single dent in the armor, in the might of the Israeli state. They don't have no effect militarily. And politically, they're a disaster. Because they push the Israeli Jewish masses into the arms of Zionism. And therefore, the tactics of Hamas are not a struggle against Zionism, but actually actively assist in strengthening, at least temporarily. That can change. But in the short run, they've served to provide a marvelous excuse to the Israeli imperialists to attack Gaza and carry out the brutal policy which they're carrying out. Now, it is clear that the rockets of Hamas were not the cause of this war. That's what they say. Yes, they always say that. If you look at the history of war, in every war in history, it's a curious thing, you know. You know, I'll tell you something. There has never been an aggressor in the whole of history, you know. None of them are aggressors. Hitler was not an aggressor. When he attacked Czechoslovakia, he was defending the Sudetenland Germans against the terrible Czechs and so on. He needed Poland because this kind of thing. None of them are aggressive. The whole purpose of diplomacy is to convert the aggressor into the victim and the victim into the aggressor. And therefore, you should pay no attention whatsoever to the nonsense, the cynicism of diplomacy. The whole purpose of it is to fool public opinion. And the Israelis are fooling public opinion in Israel by saying, we are responding to the attacks of Hamas. We are defending ourselves. And there are many people, many Jews believe this. To some extent, you can understand this. They're surrounded by a hostile sea of Arab peoples. And the notion is, these people want to kill us. That's what many Jews think. These people want to kill us. And therefore, we have to defend ourselves. Now, this is not true. Even if you look at the quantitative point of view, oh, by the way, they use this terrible language, this diplomatic euphemisms. You know, they refer to it's a disproportionate response. It's a disproportionate response. I think before the invasion, I think about five, was it five? I can't remember the figures. It's a tiny handful of Jewish people who were killed. How many?
14 since
2000. 14, that's right. That's in the whole period. That's since the beginning. There's only been 14 killed. But since the beginning of the conflict, I think there were five up until when they went into Gaza, when they stopped the bombing. A total of five Israelis have been killed. I think two of them were soldiers. Five were killed. Against 550 Palestinians, most of them women and children, and civilians. a disproportionate response. This is a response of 100 to 1. You know, the Bible says, and the ruling class, the Zionists, they believe in the Bible, at least based on the first part of the Old Testament, what we call, you know, the Pentateuch. They believe in the Old Testament. And the Old Testament says, the Bible says, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and a life for a life. There's a certain primitive logic in that. But this is not an eye for an eye. This is not a life for a... This is 100 lives for one life. That's the reality of the state of affairs. Now, it is quite clear to anyone with an ounce of reason that the rockets were not the cause. First of all, the amount of rocket attacks were actually decreasing before the bombing started. They were actually decreasing. There were dozens instead of hundreds, which they were at a certain stage. Secondly, it is clear that this military operation was very carefully planned. It's been, from a military point of view, it's a classic textbook case. They moved very quickly. Everything was in position. Everything was prepared. They cut Gaza in half, which is not difficult. By the way, those people that think that they're going to end up as they did in the Lebanon, that the Israelis are going to get into the trouble, I think they're mistaken. They're very much mistaken. We'll come to the Lebanon in a moment. But first of all, the Gaza Strip is not the Lebanon. The Lebanon is very difficult terrain for an army to fight on, a conventional army. The Gaza Strip is a miserable, it's a tiny slip of land, barren land, locked against the coast, narrow strip, it's flat. It's very simple to operate under those circumstances. Therefore, they quickly acted, they cut Gaza in half, thereby shutting off the southern half, because they're being supplied from Egypt, and they surrounded Gaza City, which they subjected to a horrific bombardment. The Israelis say, we try to avoid killing civilians. Well, if you can believe that, you can believe anything. It is clear that the position of the Israelis, they don't want to take many losses because of the effects that would have at home. But they blast away at anything that moves, it's clear. They don't necessarily want to kill these civilians deliberately, but they don't care. They just don't care. They blast away at anything that is remotely suspicious, whether it's a school, hospital, UN building. It doesn't make any difference. And there is a logic to this. There is a purpose. The purpose is to strike terror and to prove the overwhelming force of the Israeli army. That's part of it. But it still doesn't answer the question. Why did Israel choose to attack now? And what is their purpose? Unless we can answer those questions, we can't answer anything else. Now, I will remind you that about just over a year ago, I wrote an article about this on Marxist.com, there was a so-called peace conference in the United States, called by that great lover of peace, George W. Bush, the Annapolis Peace Conference. They were all the gangsters were together, the Egyptians, the Saudis were particularly interested in this. Saudis are very interested in peace. We will come to their role in a moment. And what was the result of this conference? The result was they actually passed a decision that by the end of 2008, the Israelis and Palestinians would reach a peace agreement. By the end of 2008. Instead of that, you see what is occurring. Now, I repeat the question. First of all, let's establish our position. What is the Marxist position on war? Well, first of all, we do not accept the pacifist argument, which is entirely false. You know, that great philosopher Hegel actually once wrote a very true thing. He said, all serious questions in history are solved by force. Understand that. All serious questions are solved by force. You don't like it? Well, you know, maybe you don't like it, but you better accept it because it's a fact. And all this nonsense, we'll come to the United Nations in a moment, about international law, humanitarian, it's nonsense. All serious questions are solved by law, by war. And therefore, our attitude towards war is just simply this. What we have to decide, because there are wars which are just wars, and there are wars which are unjust wars. Our attitude is very simple. There have been just wars throughout. The just war, those just wars are the wars of poor, oppressed people against their oppressors. As simple as that. And in such wars, we are duty-bound to take the side of the oppressed and the weak against the oppressors. In this case, we have to take the side of the Palestinians against Israel. There's no argument about that. Irrespective of the wrong methods of Hamas, that's got nothing to do with it. We stand with the oppressed Palestinian people against the Israeli oppressors, full stop. We discuss Hamas's methods, and we have to have an independent position on this, not an uncritical position, but that's our fundamental position. But the question arises, what's the reason for this war? Now, that's an interesting question. Well, it's a complicated question. Napoleon once said, and he knew a lot about wars, Napoleon said, war is the most complex of all equations, and this is a particularly complex equation. There are different factors, there are different reasons. There is an electoral factor, this has been raised. It's not the rockets of Hamas, we've established that. But the elections are taking place in Israel next month, that is a factor. And of course they're all competing against each other. Barak, the leader of the other party, Kadima, which is a right-wing religious party. I can never remember her name. It's a woman. Pardon? Yes, that's right. Not Liebknecht, no. It's a different name, you know. A woman! Whoa, woman! You see how marvellous the women are when they get into power. That's an answer to the feminists. Margaret Thatcher and all this scoundrel, they're the worst scoundrels. Don't talk to me about feminism. You know. Anyway, so this scoundrel, and of course Netanyahu was in opposition, was an extreme chauvinist, the Likud is the extreme chauvinist party, and they're competing against each other, particularly Barak, who's leading this war, who's supposed to be a member of the so-called Labour Party, some Labour Party, as Ted Grant once commented to me, some Labour Party. They're competing as to who's the most chauvinist, who's the hardest line on Hamas, and so that is a factor. Yes, it's a factor. It's true. But it cannot be the main factor. War is too serious a matter to be decided by trivial electoral politics. That can't be. It's a factor, but it's not the main factor. There is another more serious factor which people don't realize. The world crisis of capitalism affects all countries. And it affects Israel also. There's a serious economic crisis in Israel. It's growing unemployment, bankruptcies, increasing poverty, and undoubtedly a nice little war, chauvinism, and the external enemy is a nice way also of detracting the attention of the Israeli masses. That undoubtedly also is a factor. But if you ask my opinion, I don't think any of this is the real reason. The real reason is a date. That date is the 20th of February. Or is it January? 20th of January. It's even sooner. That's right, it's just 10 days' time. Barack Obama is going to replace George Bush as the President of the United States. Now, what does this mean? Now, you could be excused for thinking, well, it doesn't make any difference. People say, oh, it doesn't make any difference. They have the same position. They're the same. Well, yes, in general, that's true. But Obama is no better than George Bush. And Obama defends the same imperialist interest as George Bush. You see what a scoundrel he is. I mean, he's created a big myth, you know. Mr. Nice Guy, Mr. Peace, Mr. Democracy, Mr. For the Ordinary American, you know. So far, he hasn't had to do anything. In the case of the war, he's kept very quiet. Said nothing. On the grounds that America must speak with one voice. There's only one president of the United States, which fortunately is not Obama. See. There was quite an amusing cartoon in The Economist, I think, last week. There was a voice saying, Surely Mr. Obama cannot remain silent while the slaughter is taking place in Gaza. And he answers, yes, we can. many people have drawn the conclusion that there's no difference. Many people on the left and many Arabs have drawn the conclusion there's no difference between George Bush and Obama. This is not correct. Yes, in general, because they stand for the same imperialist interest, that's true. But different individuals in different parties can interpret these interests in different ways, point number one. Point number two, the conditions have changed now. You might not have noticed, the world conditions have changed quite a lot. since George W. started his war on terror, conditions have changed quite a lot. This is an entirely different situation now that Obama, this is not the 9th of September anymore. Obama has inherited a very serious economic crisis in the United States. Growing unemployment, the highest growth of unemployment, I think, for 60 years. I think in the last period, they lost 3 million jobs. Last year, they lost 3 million jobs, if my memory serves me correctly, which was the biggest figure for 60 years. And there's enormous discontent in America. You have to understand this. There's colossal discontent in the United States. Growing, dangerous discontent. The strategists of capital are seriously concerned about this. This was precisely reflected in the victory of Obama, which, if you think about it itself, was a political earthquake. And therefore, the American people, the ordinary people, the workers, the middle class, are going to want results. They're going to want jobs. They're going to want a solution to their problems. Obama has no solution to these problems. He will try to put forth some public works and so on. But there's another question involved, and that's Iraq. You must understand how all this fits together. Obama has promised to pull the American troops out of Iraq. He must do this. He must. The American people are up to here with they're fed up with Iraq. They're completely alienated. It was part of the reason why they voted against Bush. This war, from the standpoint of the American capitalists, is now costing them $2 billion every week. Just think of it. In a time of economic crisis, how can this be sustained? It cannot be sustained. And therefore, this man of peace will pull the troops out of it, not immediately, it will take some time, it's a complicated operation, but he must pull out of Iraq, must get out of it, because they've lost. He must get out of Iraq. And then this man of peace will send these fortunate American Marines to be taken out of Iraq and sent to Afghanistan. If I was an American soldier, I'm not sure, Tanvi, whether I'd be happier in Iraq, or I think I'd be happier in Iraq than in Afghanistan. But the answer is that the American people cannot fight on too many fronts. But you know, there's a problem here. There's a problem here. The problem is this. In order to be able to pull out of Iraq, America must have an agreement with two countries. They must have an agreement with Syria, and they must have an agreement with Iran. Despite all the noise that this stupid idiot George Bush was raising, you know, that he was going to attack, that Syria was a rogue, couldn't touch the Syrians, couldn't speak to the Syrians. Iran, he was going to bomb Iran or even invade Iran. We said at the time that that was nonsense. We said at the time that that was rubbish. They could not do this. And we predicted that they would have to negotiate with Syria and Iran. I know that those negotiations have started. I'm well aware that they've started. Except that they can't do it openly. The Americans can't discuss with this terrorist state, Syria. So they send their office boy from London. A chap called Miliband. Horrible bastard. It's a poor imitation of Tony. He's been discussing with the Syrians. Incidentally, the Syrian economy is in a mess. The collapsing, you have to think this out. Falling oil prices have destabilized the whole of the Middle East. Falling oil prices, the official rate of unemployment in Syria is now about 20%. And Iran, as we've explained in previous discussions, the Iranian regime is hanging by a thread now. It's hanging by a thread. The falling oil price of oil is going to hit them hard. The masses anyway are fed up with this regime of the mullahs. Ahmadinejad will be removed, it's clear. They're preparing to remove Ahmadinejad. He'll be replaced by some reformer, probably, what's his name? Khatami, isn't it? Khatami, isn't it? Or Rafsanjani, whatever. It might be Khatami, actually. Again. Might be Khatami again. Some reform of it, because the ground is shaking under their feet. There's been mass strikes in Iran. There's also been mass strikes in Egypt. That's another element in the position. But either way, the Americans must enter into discussions with Iran and with Syria. In these discussions, in order to protect their rear, otherwise it would be a disaster. If they were to withdraw and there were still hostilities taking place, they'd be in serious trouble. It'll be like Saigon. They can't afford that. The best we can. Oh, in these discussions, the Palestinian question will be on the table. Yes. Because Syria and Iran pose as friends of Palestine. They pay the bills for Hamas and Hezbollah. They send them arms. And here they are discussing with the Americans. Now the question is, what will the result of these discussions be? What are they going to discuss? And by the way, the Palestinians will not participate in these discussions. Hamas certainly will not participate in these discussions. History shows many examples, on many times of history, the rights of small nations have been used as small coins, small change. You know small change? You know what that is? Let me see if I've got it in my pocket. There we are. The Palestinians. That's the Palestinians. Small change, small coins, which can be exchanged for other purposes. And therefore, this is also a threat. It's a threat to Hamas, who must be concerned about this. Hamas, the Americans can pull the rug out of the feet of Hamas at any time. And above all, it's a threat to Israel. And we have to be clear on one thing here. Many people think that the interests of Israel and America are the same. This is not true. The interests of America and Israel are not the same, necessarily. What is true is that Israel, at this moment in time and for a long time past, is the only reliable ally of the USA in the Middle East. That's a fact. The only reliable, stable ally that they got is Israel. And therefore, in the past, the Americans were compelled to accept whatever the Israelis did, particularly during the Cold War, when the Soviet Union was a force in the Middle East. The Soviet Union controlled countries like Syria, Iraq, Egypt. They were under the control of the Soviet Union. And therefore, the United States always supported the Israelis on whatever they did. They had a blank check. You see, but that's no longer the case. No, it's not quite the case. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, things have changed somewhat. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, it's no longer necessary for America to support the Israelis on everything. On the contrary, they wanted to reach agreements with the Arab countries. After all, the Arabs have got a lot of oil, which the Americans need. The Middle East is an important area. And therefore, there was a change in American foreign policy. They began to discuss with states like Egypt and so on, Saudi Arabia, of course, Jordan, other Arab states, which they're propping up, which they need to support. And they put pressure on Israel to do a deal with to give the Palestinians something, to do a deal. Now, we have to be clear on this. When we talk about a solution to the Palestinian problems, this is a concrete question. This is not an abstract question. This is a very so someone that says to me, no, we have to solve the Palestinian problem. We have to solve the question of Israel and the Arabs. I say, how, my friend? How? Concretely. Be specific. Be concrete. Generalities are no good in this situation. Now you tell me how it can be solved. So the solution that they come up with is the two-state solution. They had the negotiations in Madrid and then in Oslo at Camp David. They came up with this idea of a Palestinian state, which was no state at all. I mean, this is a joke. It was an unviable statelet. Gaza was separated from the West Bank. They handed power to these corrupt elements, these corrupt gangsters, actually, and the leaders of the PLO, who, incidentally, let's be clear on this, played no role whatsoever in the struggle against Israel for the whole of the last. But this is nonsense. Oh, yes, the struggle for liberation, the armed struggle. I say, what armed struggle? There was no armed struggle, except for useless acts of terrorism, which the PLO engaged in for about 40 years. To no result. You know, I'll tell you something that you don't know. We had discussions. I don't know if I mentioned this to Serge. Tanvir might know this. In 1970, our tendency was visited in London by representatives of the PLO, 1970. And they had discussions with Ted Grant. And Ted was quite frank with them, was quite blunt with them. Incidentally, if the Palestinians, if the PLO had had a serious revolutionary strategy, our policies if you like, they could have played a very revolutionary role in the whole of the Middle East, because the Palestinians since 48 have been dispersed through all the countries. By the way, the Palestinians at that time had no religious tradition at all, no tradition of Islamic fundamentalism. They were secular. In fact, they called themselves socialists or even Marxists in some cases. And they could have played a very important role, except that they were blinded by nationalism and by anti-Israeli feelings, if you like. Now, the question is, on the question of Israel, let's make this clear. Our tendency, the Marxist tendency, was opposed to the setting up of the State of Israel in 1948. We were radically opposed to it. Trotsky already explained that in advance. In the 1930s, he warned that the setting up of a Jewish state in the Middle East, in Palestine, would be a cruel trap for the Jewish people. And that prediction has been shown to be correct. A cruel trap for the Jewish people. Well, what else is it? What has been solved after 50 years? They just celebrated the 50th anniversary last year. What's been solved? What has been solved? It's one war after another, one horror after another, without end on this basis. So we would oppose to that. Yes, but we must make this clear. Incidentally, one point. The Jews were not a nation. The Jews never have been a nation. They're not a nation. The Jews living in many different countries. The German Jews speak German. The French Jews speak German. They don't have a common language. They don't have a common territory. Are they a religion? Well, not all Jews are religious. What are they? The nearest that Lenin could come to a definition is that they were a peculiar oppressed caste. But the Jews were not a nation and are not a nation. But Israel is a different matter. You see, you have to face facts. We have to face facts. The fact is, and we have to say this to our Palestinian friends and say this quite bluntly, after 50 years, Israel exists. It is a nation and it does exist. Not the Jews, but Israel exists. There is a nation called Israel. And therefore, when we discuss the national problem and national rights in the Middle East, we defend the rights of the Palestinians. It goes without saying. We've been the victims of a terrible injustice to be thrown off the land which they occupied for 2,000 years and so on. It's just, it would be like the Welsh, of which I am one, driving out these German illegal immigrants that came there, called the English. You know, that's what the English are. They're German illegal immigrants. They came to our country after the fall of the Roman Empire. They didn't have visas or anything. They took the place over by force. So just imagine, it might not be a bad idea for the Welsh to demand, because we were there 2,000 years ago, so give it back, give London back. It's just a joke. There's no basis to that. So it was a terrible injustice that was committed against the Palestinian people. Yes, that's true. But unfortunately, what is done and cannot be undone. You can't liquidate the State of Israel. It's not possible. And therefore, one way or whatever solution is adopted, whatever is adopted, you must have a situation whereby the Palestinians, yes, have a homeland of their own, which they can feel at home, which they can control their own affairs. And the Jewish people also, the Israeli people also, must have a territory of their own, which they control and which they can sort out their own affairs. How this is done is another matter. Personally, our tendency is not in favor of the two-state solution. But somehow a solution must be found, which I will suggest later on at the end of my talk. In any event, the imperialists, the Americans, put heavy pressure on Israel to make concessions. The result was an abortion. They handed over power to Arafat and the PLO, who were completely corrupt. The real reason why they got even that was nothing to do with the PLO. It was because of the heroic resistance of the ordinary Palestinian people in the two intifadas. Oh, by the way, I forgot to finish what I was saying. They came to London to discuss with Ted Grant. And Ted was quite frank with them, brutally frank. He said, now look, Why are you wasting your time with terrorist activities, blowing up planes, kidnapping people, assassinations? Why don't you organize, why don't you arm the people, the Palestinians on the West Bank? Infiltrate arms, you could have done. Now, we're not pacifists. We understand the need for armed struggle. Yes, but in the form of an insurrection. Prepare a mass insurrection on the West Bank. You could infiltrate. We even suggest small groups of 10 fighters in each area and so on, such that the masses would be prepared. What was the reply of the PLO representative? Oh, no, this is impossible. Impossible. You can't do anything on the West Bank. The Israeli state is too strong and so on. With the result that when the Intifada took place in the 1980s, what was the date? I can't remember. 87. When the Intifada was a marvelous movement, it was, the PLO played no role whatsoever in that Intifada. None. And unfortunately, the masses were disarmed. They had no arms, they had no weapons. And therefore, although they had a lot of sympathy in Israel, and even with the Israeli army, soldiers refused to fight and so on, if they'd have had a revolutionary leadership and arms, the result of that struggle could have been entirely different, but it wasn't, and therefore it was defeated. Yes, but it had a result. Anyway, this so-called two-state solution was no solution at all, and therefore it created colossal disappointment. Plus, of course, the corruption, the rotten corruption of the PLO leaders, the Fatah leaders, very, very degenerate, corrupt, repressive people, which led to the rise of Hamas, which never existed before. There was no such thing as a fundamentalist trend among the Palestinians. None at all. That's as a result of the crimes of the PLO leaders. That Hamas, that these religious fundamentalists with the idea of martyrdom and so on arose. And they got, because of the disgust, not because the ordinary Gazans supported the ideas of the Hamas, they didn't, they still don't. But because of the disgust with the natural disgust with Arafat and the PLO, they won the elections. Now it is a fact. What was the date of the elections? 86, was it?
Not 86.
2005. That's right. Hamas won the elections. Now, whether you like it or not, we don't agree with it. Hamas won the elections. Now, what was the attitude of these great Western Democrats? You know, they're very democratic. They're all in favor of elections as long as our side wins. You know, if we win, then it's okay. But if our side doesn't win, then they soon try to undermine the elected government. And they started to sabotage the government of Gaza by the most vicious means, by economic blockade. Incidentally, on the question of war, wars can be caused by different means, not just military means. Wars can be caused by economic means. Let me ask you a question. If any country in the world, the United States, Germany, Austria, Britain, or any other country, was subject to an economic blockade, all its links with the outside world were cut, it was not allowed to trade, it was deprived of food and medicine, its ports were closed, what do you think would happen? That would be a motive for war. You declare war. Any country in the world would declare war. And I suppose Hamas, in their own clumsy way, declared war by suicide bombings and missiles, which is quite counterproductive. This was leading to a serious position, particularly in Egypt. Now, in my opinion, Egypt and Iran are the two key countries to watch here. The two key countries in the area. Egypt is in a deep crisis. It's in a deep economic crisis. Egypt has a powerful working class, where there have been big strikes. It's led by a very repressive pro-Western regime, which is obviously very shaky. And in addition to the unemployment, the poverty, the misery, the suffering of the Egyptian masses, now they have this monstrosity of the Gaza situation. They tried, which was very dangerous for Egypt. And therefore, with the aid of Saudi Arabia, they went to George Bush, to Uncle Sam, and asked, please sort something out. Please have a word with the Israelis. Please do something. Which they had. So they had this Annapolis conference. They arrived at a ceasefire, And they arrived at a deal. As I said at the beginning, they were going to reach an agreement by December of 2008. What was the result? Immediately, the Israelis had no intention of respecting. They intensified their provocations. In effect, it amounted to a state of siege. They were slowly strangling Gaza, as a matter of fact. Hamas then replied with more rockets and so on. But the whole purpose of this was the Israelis were determined to intervene. By the way, part of the reason why they've intervened was the defeat that they had in Lebanon in 2006. They had a bloody nose in. They were too arrogant in Lebanon, and Hezbollah gave them a bloody nose. But you see, the Israeli army is a very powerful army, and they've decided now to teach the Arabs a lesson, in effect, in Gaza. I don't think it will end up the same as Lebanon. If Hamas thinks that, then they're mistaken. Although the Israeli army will take some losses, but they don't care. They don't care if they take losses. They don't care how many civilians are killed, because they must teach Hamas a very serious lesson, which all the others must take note of, including Hezbollah. The warning is this: you try any funny business with us and you're going to get the same treatment, which they're quite able to do. Now, to go back to what I was saying earlier, all this means what? This war is, if you can call it a war, it's a very one-sided war. Perhaps war isn't the best expression for it. It's more like a massacre. This conflict is a warning from Israel to the rest of the world, including Obama and the United States. Ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, we are here, and we can destroy any peace process that you care to organize, okay? So don't, when you reach your diplomatic agreements, which we know you are involved in, you remember that Israel is here, and Israel will have something to say on the subject. This is a little warning for Obama. Incidentally, Hamas, I don't think they're too, I think they must have had a bit of a shock, but in a sense it also suits them. They've achieved also something from this. Hamas, the poor Palestinians caught in the middle are the ones that suffer, but Hamas have increased temporarily their support in the Arab world. That suits them also. But you see, the big question from a Marxist point of view is this. First of all, sooner or later, this conflict logically must come to an end. The Israelis have no intention of occupying Gaza. That's not the intention. The intention was to go in, smash the place up, kill as many of Hamas's people as possible, wreck their ability to fight. They've said in Israel, their declared aim is to stop the rockets. Now, that's easier said than done. How do you stop the rockets? These are small rockets. These are homemade rockets which can be easily moved. Furthermore, even if Hamas were to order a ceasefire, there are other groups which are more extreme than Hamas that won't necessarily accept. So it will be difficult to stop, but at least they must largely stop the fire. They must inflict a very severe defeat on Hamas. That's why there was a ceasefire appeal made by the United Nations. The U.S. abstained. First of all, the Americans blocked even a resolution. That shows the United Nations. They blocked it at the beginning because they wanted to give the Israelis time to smash Hamas. It'll take a little bit longer. Finally, because of the pressure of world public opinion, they were compelled. This time they abstained. The Americans abstained on the vote. The United Nations voted. They sent the resolution to Israel. And you know what the Israelis did with this resolution? You know what they did with it? Same as they've done with all the other United Nations resolutions for the last 50 years. They sent it to the toilet, where it's got a useful purpose. They pay no attention. They just throw it away. They pay no attention. And they've said, well, we've read your resolution. Thank you very much. And then they continue. And they will continue. They will continue remorselessly until they consider that their military aims are met. Now, the problem is this. The petty bourgeois pacifists, of course, they think this is terrible. Oh, War, people are being killed, and of course it is terrible. And of course we are desperately sorry about the fate of these poor devils, these poor ordinary people that are being slaughtered. It is a terrible thing. But it's a terrible thing that's the product of capitalism and imperialism and the whole mess that they've created in the Middle East. So moralistic statements, whether you can feel as sorry as you like, that doesn't solve anything. You must look for solutions here. Now, the sooner or later they will reach an agreement. But the question is this. The petty bourgeois pacifists, when they consider war, which they always do from a superficial, moralistic, sentimental point of view, which is no good at all, hopeless position. What they don't understand is that wars tend to have another side. Lenin explained that wars frequently cause revolutions. We're commemorating the German Revolution of 1919. That was the result of a war, don't forget. Wars tend to produce revolutions. They upset things. They upset the status quo. That's why, in particular, the Europeans are getting very worried. After all, they're quite close to the Middle East. America is a long way away. France has got its own interests. Sarkozy is playing his own game. They want oil, as a matter of fact. They want nice relations with the Arabs. But the reason why the Europeans have sent not just one mission for peace, but two. Two for the price of one. You know. One of them is headed by Tony Blair. I mean, if you wanted to send someone to the Arabs to negotiate peace, I think they could have chosen a better candidate than Tony Blair. These missions, they will have no effect. But the question, they'll have no effect because what I've said, the Israelis are going to stay there until they've achieved what they consider are their aims, which I've explained. The question we have to ask is, why are the Europeans so worried? Some of the Americans now are getting worried. Even some of the Israelis are getting worried. I was interested, I don't know if you saw that, Tamir, a former minister of Mossad, the secret police, made a statement to the effect that, well, we should include Hamas in any future peace negotiations. It's an extraordinary state of affairs for the ex-leader of Mossad to say. Why are they getting worried? They're getting worried because they can see the destabilizing effects that this is having throughout the whole region. Serious destabilizing effects. You see all these demonstrations that they've stirred things up. You see all these marvelous mass demonstrations that have taken place all over the Middle East and in Turkey. There's also a mass demonstration on the West Bank, of course. And by the way, Abbas has been seriously damaged by this. All these demonstrations are taking place in Egypt and so on. Now the question is this. These demonstrations are about what? They're not just about Palestine. They're an expression of rage, of frustration, of anger, of hatred for the regimes in those countries. For the regime in Egypt. Saudi Arabia is hanging by a thread. That's a serious question for the Americans. The Egyptian regime, in my opinion, could be overthrown at any time. Jordan, the same, could be overthrown. And therefore, out of this terrible war, there can be revolutionary consequences. You better believe it. That's why they're so desperate. Peace, peace, please, ceasefire. Stop this, peace. Of course. They can see what we can see. And by the way, this is the only real hope for the Palestinian people. The only hope for the Palestinian people is to merge their struggle for national liberation, which of course we support, with the general revolutionary movement of the Arab people, particularly the Arab proletariat in Egypt. Ultimately, the only solution for the problem of the Palestinians would be a general revolution in the Middle East. Israel could not remain outside of that. And by the way, the idea that the Israeli people are just one reactionary bloc, which these idiots maintain, which is quite untrue. If it were true, then you could kiss goodbye to the Palestinian national problem. Forget it. And then we'd have no solution. Then you'd have a nightmare scenario. If it were true that the Israeli nation were one reactionary bloc. It is not true. Israel consists of classes, rich and poor. There have been, in the recent peace strikes and even general strikes in Israel. In the past, the Palestinians have had support within Israel, mass demonstrations. I remember the time of the time of the Lebanese war, the Lebanon massacre. There was the biggest demonstration in the history of Israel in support of the Palestinians. So don't tell me that it's just one reactionary mass. The problem is that if the Palestinians use incorrect methods, as Hamas is using incorrect methods, that would tend to push the ordinary Israelis into the other camp. And therefore, what is required is not nationalism cannot solve this problem. There is no, on the basis of bourgeois nationalism, there's no solution. With your permission, I'll just take 5 minutes extra to deal with this question of the two-state theory. I have not the slightest doubt, although this might sound strange to you, I have not the slightest doubt that when the fighting is finished, and sooner or later it will finish, the Israelis will withdraw after they've done enough damage. After they've done enough damage, they will not destroy Hamas. But they can do it serious damage, but they can't destroy it completely. But you see, the problem is, what comes after? Now, I noticed that Obama has made statements, and the Israelis have made statements, that after this conflict is over, we are not going to return to the status quo. Condoleezza Rice said that. By the way, Serge reminded me that Condoleezza Rice is an ex-Trotskyist. Am I right, Serge? That's right. Our comments are astonished. There's a stunned silence. She's not the only one in this administration that's an ex-Trotskyist. Anyway, she said, Condoleezza Rice says there's no return to the status quo, and I think that's correct. I think that's... What does it mean? What do these words mean? Well, it means that they must, because they want peace. They all want peace. You understand? George W. Bush wants peace. Yes. No, why do you laugh? It's true. George W. Bush wants peace in the Middle East. Peace under American control. The problem is you can have peace or you can have American control. You can't have both. That's the problem. But in any case, to go back to this question, they will have to negotiate, they will go back to this question of a Palestinian state. And I think that they'll move to set up a Palestinian state. Right? Better. Problem. There are some little problems here. First problem. What would the frontier of this state be? The Israelis would have something to say about that. They already built a wall slicing off whole sections of the West Bank. The Israelis, by the way, they're not interested in Gaza. They're interested in the West Bank. Gaza is of no importance. They're building a wall. Where's the frontier? Who decides the frontier? Point number two, Jerusalem, which the Israelis say is the inalienable, traditional, national capital, which they will not renounce. And the Arabs say the same thing. So, what's happening over Jerusalem? Thirdly, the settlers. Despite all the agreements, they've been setting up settlers, Israeli Jewish settlers, inside Palestinian territory. This is a serious problem. They would have to dismantle these settlements, which is a difficult thing to do, especially with the religious parties in the government. And fourthly, the right of return. There are millions of Palestinians who live, refugees all over the Middle East, who would like to return to Israel. But the Israelis can't allow this. These are very serious difficulties, very serious problems, which they've never been able to solve. They discuss and they discuss and they discuss and eventually it breaks down. And that's what's going to happen, in my view. In the next period, I'll predict now. What will happen is there'll be a new deal and that'll break down. There'll be new wars, new terrorism, new murders, new slaughters. And then another deal and that will break down to the end of the world. But this problem cannot be solved on a capitalist basis. What would be the solution? I will finish on this. What would be the only solution? The only solution would be, and it is possible, it's quite possible, that the national movement of the Palestinians must be linked to a general program of revolution throughout the Middle East, starting with these reactionary, corrupt, rotten Arab regimes, Egypt and so on, which and Iran. Just wait, you see what will happen in Iran in the next period. The revolution is on the agenda. That would have a colossal impact inside Israel, particularly if the socialist revolution in Egypt and Iran had a Marxist leadership that made an internationalist appeal, appealing to the ordinary people of Israel that this is senseless, that we wish to live in peace, that we can discuss our affairs, but that this reactionary Zionist state must be overthrown. In other words, to drive a wedge along class lines. That's the only solution. And then what would be our program? Our program would be a socialist federation of the Middle East with autonomy, an autonomous region for the Jews, if you like, and an autonomous region for the Arabs, for the Kurds also. There are many national problems in that area, which cannot be solved on a capitalist basis. They do not admit of a solution. That's the only solution. And finally, just one final word. Those that say to me, oh, no, but the Jews and the Arabs, they will never live together. They hate each other. It's kind of organic hatred, you know, which is nonsense. Let me provide just two proofs from history which shows that this is not the case. Look, in Russia, before 1917, there was a very severe national problem. Not just the oppression of the Jews, which was a savage repression of the Jews, but also oppression of people like the class between the Armenians and the Azeris, who were Muslims. There were slaughters, there were pogroms in Baku, the Baku pogrom, I think during the First World War. And you could put forth the same argument. It's impossible for these people to live together. They're always killing each other and so on. After the 1917, the problem was solved in the Soviet Union by revolutionary means. The problem was solved by means of a Soviet federation with autonomous republics. There was an Azeri autonomous republic. There was an Armenian autonomous republic who lived completely peacefully on the basis of a planned economy, increased living standards and so on, because in the last analysis, the national problem is better. Only now, with the breakup of the Soviet Union, you've got war between Azerbaijan and Armenia with ghastly results. One final example, which you may not know. Yugoslavia, as you know, is composed of different nationalities, different republics. There are Croats and Serbs, who were traditionally supposed to be enemies. There was a vicious struggle between Croats and Serbs, so much so that during the Second World War, there was a Nazi puppet regime in Croatia, the Ustasi regime in Croatia, a vicious regime, which viciously oppressed the Serbs. The Serbs were the oppressed nationality in this case. The oppression was so bad, there were concentration camps, including Serbs. Many Serbs and Gypsies were sent to concentration camps and exterminated. The conditions in those camps in Croatia were so bad that the German officers, the Nazi officers, complained about the brutality in these concentration camps. Just imagine the horrors that occurred. Terrible. And you could say, well, Serbs and Croats can't live together, which is stupid because they even speak the same language and so on. Oh, no, they can't live together. There's a history of slaughter. After the victory of Tito, and this was a Stalinist regime, it wasn't a genuine democratic worker state, but it was at least a step forward, Tito was actually a Croat himself. And after that, the problem was largely solved for generations, for decades, on the basis of a planned economy, full employment, 10% annual growth rate, and so on. There was intermarriage, people lived together quite happily. Again, I repeat, it's only the breakdown of that and the restoration of capitalism that has brought these horrors and this nightmare of ethnic cleansing and racism and slaughter, which everybody thought was belonged to the past. It's a product of capitalism. The national question is the product of capitalism and is intensified by the crisis of capitalism. And therefore, I'll finish on this, the only genuine solution for the Palestinian people and for the Israeli people is on a revolutionary, socialist and internationalist basis. Beyond that, no solution to this terrible problem will ever be found.